Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The White House has given agencies until the end of this year to make sure their use of artificial intelligence is safe and fair. It tells practitioners to keep humans in that proverbial loop and to let people opt out of AI applications, like at the airport, and to stop using AI if they can't meet the safeguard rules. How feasible is all of this? Well, for one view, we turn to the principal security consultant for the cybersecurity company NCC Group, David Brockler. Mr. Brockler, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And everybody is really running around almost like a chicken with its head off over AI. And we've seen this type of technological wonder come into the government. They don't always pan out. Do you think AI is going to be really big, or is it the next blockchain?
Yeah, that's always an interesting question. Whenever we're dealing with a paradigm shift of technology, there's always the potential that we're dealing with the next internet. This is the next big thing. On the other hand, this might fizzle out in the next 5 years, and we realize that its use cases are a lot more limited than we had initially anticipated. So right now, we're still in the honeymoon phase with AI. The government actually released a list of their intended use cases where they think that they could put AI to good use. But as it turns out, it's almost a wish list rather than a direct plan of attack for the near future. So I think that we'll see a lot of interesting avenues in the next several years, but whether or not they pan out is anybody's guess.
And some of the use cases they mention, like facial recognition, this is not new, and it was never called AI. Are we kind of retrofitting the word AI onto just sophisticated logic algorithms or processes that were there all along?
I think if you go back 5 years, you'll have found that we call it machine learning. And this is something that we've been doing for decades now. And of course, it's been more sophisticated in recent years. But everything from cybersecurity with detecting threats on systems to facial recognition, we've been seeing these technologies at play. But now, because AI is the big buzzword that's been receiving big funding, all of these organizations are rushing to use that to apply to their use cases. Now, it might truly be some form of AI, but in the end, a lot of these aren't truly novel, and they're more iterational over what we've already seen.
And getting to the particular follow-on to the executive order, I guess it was from last October, now we have this new recent March of 24 directive on the safety of it. What do agencies actually have to do here, do you think, to summarize it all?
Sure. Well, a couple of the key points that I noticed is that the transparency and accountability guidelines require individuals to be able to opt out of certain AI use cases. So, for example, if you go to the airport and they're using facial recognition, an individual needs to have the ability to opt out of that facial tracking without it negatively impacting their ability to get on the plane. And personally, I think that that's a phenomenal step forward for these individual rights to say, I don't want to be a part of this tracking technology. They also indicated that they wanted to release these models to the public, which provides ample opportunity for what I call a public-private collaboration, where the individuals and the public can see these models that are released by the government, poke at them, and we can use this to figure out, here are the next things we can do to make AI better for everybody, not just one organization or one federal agency.
Well, are they maybe creating a straw man there? Because remember when the first scanners came that showed the outline of the human body in some anatomical detail, and people were worried about being seen in that manner and whether those pictures were in fact kept. They weren't kept. They were just used in that moment and then never stored anywhere. And then they abstracted the human anatomy so that you could still see what was in the pocket, but you couldn't see what was underneath the pocket, to put it that way. And they don't keep the photo images until the matching is done, then they're disposed of. So is it a real fear there? And should someone have the right to opt out when in fact the picture's destroyed the second it's used?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting question in that regard. And a lot of individuals feel differently about what their personal risk tolerance looks like. And that's something we talk about in the security industry and with the NCC Group a lot, is that every individual and every organization is willing to deal with a different amount of risk. So for some people, they might say, you know, I have decent confidence that this is going to be implemented correctly. And I'm not even going to say that it has to be maliciously. It could just be a mistake. But they're saying, I'm not willing to put up with the idea that somebody might make that mistake and my information could be released out there somewhere. Another individual might say, who cares? I have a driver's license. They already have my face. And so we're dealing with individuals who have different risk tolerances, who are willing to put up with different amounts of toy with their personal data.
We're speaking with David Brockler. He's a principal security consultant for the NCC Group. And you have postulated the idea of another chief, that is a chief AI officer. We've got chief data officers and 10 other chief this, that, and the other. What would a chief AI officer do that should not already be invested in the security people, the IT people, the program people, and the privacy people?
It seems like there are more chiefs every year. But when it comes to these more specialized roles, like chief information security officer, or in this case, chief AI officer, we're looking for individuals who have dedicated experience with the technology at hand. So while you might have a CEO of an organization who doesn't know a whole lot about security, but they know a lot about business, you're going to need to have a chief AI officer who is in the weeds for how AI is implemented. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to understand all of the math and the calculus that goes on behind the scenes, but they do need to understand those privacy and security risks that AI introduces to an organization. And whether that be a business or an agency, these organizations need to be aware of how they're using AI and how it's impacting their data flows within that organization.
And on the question of the human in the loop, that's emphasized very early and strongly in that executive order, or that follow-on order. I don't hear anyone that promulgates AI without saying the same thing. Have you seen any use cases where you'd have a runaway situation, you know, Revenge of the Robots or type of scenario I guess people worry about? Maybe discuss how you keep the human in the loop and make sure that is a cultural norm that every agency would follow.
Absolutely. In terms of those runaway use cases, we've seen systems designed in such a way that we can end up with those unfortunate feedback loops. On the other hand, it is fortunate that we're early enough in the days of AI that it probably isn't going to result in any catastrophic implications. So, for example, an organization who uses AI to sign documents is probably not going to be in a business-ending scenario if that goes out of control without human intervention. And on our research blog, research.nccgroup.com, we've put some of those examples of how AI can go wrong when implemented improperly. But as these technologies are used in more critical infrastructure and in more sensitive use cases, it is imperative that somebody can step in at any given moment and say, this is being used improperly, and we need to make sure and effectively add checks and balances to the AI's decision-making process. We don't want a fully automated healthcare solution. We're talking about risk of life and limb here. And so when AI is, from a big picture perspective, an advanced automation solution, we have to have a person there double-checking the results, I would say forever, but at least until we're confident that AI can make decisions better than any person ever could.
And is it possible to make, say, the applications of generative AI accountable and traceable and auditable? I'll make the analogy of Boeing, you know, which is having issues with manufacturing quality, but every rivet and screw is documented. And if one screw goes in wrong and they replace it, that's actually got to be documented so that everything can be audited later on. Can you do that with training data and training inputs to generative AI?
It's an interesting case, and I would say tentatively, yes. Organizations can keep track of everything that goes into these systems and everything that comes out of them. However, when we put things into a model, there is the risk that they, in a sense, disappear into this larger amalgamation of data that is being processed. And so as a result, you can end up with a case where an organization or an agency is feeding a person's data into this model. They throw away that data and think that they're safe because it's been lost in the ether of AI. And then somewhere down the line, a threat actor or effectively a hacker goes in, talks to the AI and figures out the magic words that they need to whisper in order to extract this data from the model. So whenever an AI sees something, we can't be confident that that ends up going away, which is the same reason that no organization should be feeding third-party AIs confidential internal information from their organizations. For example, I've seen individuals send source code to, say, OpenAI's ChatGPT. But they don't realize that when they're doing that, they're effectively exposing it for the world to see. It's just a matter of time before that is later leaked from the model itself.
So you might say the output of generative AI is a cake that can be unbaked.
It is a cake that can be split open, I would say. It's difficult to remove data, but it is possible to see what was put into it to begin with.
All right, better way of putting it. David Brockler is Principal Security Consultant for the NCC Group. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me. I had a great time.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive, along with a link to a fact sheet about that latest White House directive. Hear the Federal Drive on your schedule. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. what's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs. That's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're,
Thank you.
Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.